Hello, and welcome to Science World. A new exhibit at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History in Washington celebrates genetic research. We'll hear how India is using its railway system for not only transportation, but as a vehicle to teach children science. And scientists are predicting a possible record-breaking dead zone or area of water with little or no oxygen this summer in the Gulf of Mexico. The director of the Center for Sponsored Coastal Ocean Research joins us later to tell us more about this dire prediction. This and much more are coming up for you on VOA Science Health and Technology Magazine, Science World. A new exhibit at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History in Washington celebrates two scientific milestones, the 10th anniversary of the completion of the Human Genome Project and the 60th anniversary of the discovery of DNA's double helix structure. Roseanne Skirbel tells us more.
The four chemicals that make up the fabric of our being are on display in a mesmerizing variety of ways throughout the exhibit. From photographs of faces highlighting genetic differences to an endless scroll of the letters representing them in our genome, A, G, C, and T, on a TV screen, to those same letters projected in eye-popping orange on a mannequin, says exhibit developer Meg Rivers.
She has on her the human genetic code, and she is meant to really engage visitors and get them to think about having their own code and what does it mean to them.
Rivers says visitors get that chance thanks to 3D models, animated videos, personal stories, touch panels, interactive games, and genetic sequencing equipment.
And you're able to go into these different alcoves looking at personalized medicine, exploring medical mysteries, what does it mean to your health, the ethical, legal, social implications that people are now starting to come across in the media, looking at our ancient ancestry up to today and what genomic science means to our natural world of our understanding it and our environment.
But genomic science is not static. A scrolling news line keeps visitors up to date on the latest medical breakthroughs. Eric Green is director of the National Human Genome Research Institute, which collaborated with the Smithsonian to create the exhibit. He says the overall aim is to raise genomic literacy, which is important.
Because already starting, but absolutely by the end of this decade, genomics will become very much part of medical care in areas like cancer, in areas like infectious disease, in areas like deciding which medications to give people, in areas especially related to rare diseases that have genetic causes. So this is going to become part of the language of medical care, and people are going to need to start to become familiar with it.
For 12-year-old Kellen Alfaro, that immersion starts now, as she joins her classmates in a hands-on activity to capture her own DNA.
Hi, guys. Y'all ready to isolate your DNA?
Yes.
Kellen is on board as she swishes water around in her mouth.
Chew on your cheeks a little and get some of those cells out in your spit.
Okay.
And that'll help a lot. Help a lot.
Do it now?
Yeah, go ahead and do it now.
Her saliva goes into a little cup and then is poured into a tube.
You should start seeing this DNA. It's a little white strand. I see it.
Kellen caps the tube to turn it into a pendant for a necklace.
I'm going to take home a necklace that has my DNA inside it.
Are you going to wear this all the time?
Yes, because it defines me and it tells me who I am and where I come from.
A lesson well learned, says teacher Andrea Conway.
This helps us in the classroom because it not only gives students an opportunity to be excited about what we're learning, but it helps us to actually make connections to different things that we've learned about before in terms of human life and plant and animals.
7.5 million people visit the National Museum of Natural History each year. They'll have a chance to unlock life's code for themselves through September. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
According to a new study, overweight or obese patients with type 2 diabetes who lost a significant amount of weight were at the same risk of heart attack as those who did not diet intensively. Jessica Berman reports.
Experts say there's plenty of short-term evidence that weight loss through diet and exercise benefits those with type 2 diabetes, reducing their risk factors such as elevated cholesterol and blood pressure that contribute to heart attack and stroke. But there's little or no data on the long-term health benefits of weight loss and lifestyle modification in type 2 diabetics. Researchers participating in a multi-center, 10-year study looked at the effect of diet and exercise on over 5,100 overweight and obese type 2 diabetics. Half of the participants were randomized into a weight loss group. Instead of intensive exercise and adopting a reduced-calorie diet, the other participants received information about diabetes and support in managing their disease. John Forrett, director of the Behavior Medicine Research Center at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas, oversaw the school's participation in the study. Forrett says participants in the intensive lifestyle group lost more weight, around 6% of their body mass, and did a better job of keeping off the kilos than the control group. Compared to the non-intervention group, Forrett says the exercise and diet group also lowered almost all of their cardiovascular risk factors.
But did not have less heart attacks and strokes. That is, there was no difference in the number of heart attacks and strokes between the control group and the intervention group. Both groups had less than we had anticipated, which was good news, but it didn't show the differences.
But Forrett says there's still plenty of reasons for people with type 2 diabetes to lose weight and exercise regularly. He says type 2 diabetics who dieted and exercised intensively saw an increase in their good cholesterol, required lower doses of medicines to control blood sugar and cholesterol levels, had fewer signs of aging, and improved physical functioning.
It's just that the mortality wasn't there, the difference. But everything else, you know, if you want to feel better, quality of life, less depression, all of these factors we've measured, and all of them were significant in the intervention group. So there's more reason than ever, if you have type 2 diabetes and you're overweight, to lose weight and to keep it off.
The results of the long-term diabetes trial, funded by the U.S. National Institutes of Health, were presented at the annual American Diabetes Association meeting in Chicago and published in the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
India's railway system is one of the largest and busiest in the world. But it's not just for passengers. The Indian government is utilizing this vast network to provide children in the most remote corners of the country with a moving classroom. Aru Pandey has more from New Delhi.
Raghav Pandya loves science, so much so that he spends 6 months out of the year on this train to help share his passion with youngsters across India.
I am passionate about spreading and popularizing awareness regarding scientific knowledge and kind of mechanisms, what are relating and what are surrounding to us. The people wanted to know why it is and how it is.
All experiments, Rika, you have seen that experiment.
Pandya is one of 40 postgraduates who make the Science Express train their home as it travels 19,000 kilometers throughout India from April to October of this year. The train will stop at 62 different locations, including here in the Indian capital, where hundreds of students line up to get their chance to see exhibits focusing on biodiversity, conservation, and climate change. More than 8.5 million people have visited the mobile exhibition, a project India's Prime Minister launched in 2007 to attract young people back to science. Department of Science and Technology advisor Chandra Mohan was tasked with finding a way to reverse what he says was a growing disinterest in the field.
Why not take science to the people instead of people coming to science? And what better way than the Indian Railway network, which is so vast that it is the largest network in the world, and it is stretched across the country. Each and every nook and corner of India is connected by railway network.
The train stops at each station for 3 to 4 days, and young people have a chance to take part in the hands-on laboratory, where educators help them conduct experiments highlighting math and science principles. For some of these children, particularly from small towns in the farthest corners of India, this is a rare opportunity to learn beyond the four walls of their classroom. Seeing their reaction makes riding the rails worth it for educators like Raghav Pandya.
Fascinating experiments or sort of things, when they come to know, they feel, oh wow. So this wow factor we come to know, we come to see in their eyes, is because in our ages, in our childhood, we have not got such sort of exposure.
What is this?
The Science Express train is making its way through eastern India, with stops planned in West Bengal and Orissa states in July. The moving exhibit is expected to attract its 10 millionth visitor by the end of this year. Arup Pandey, VOA News, New Delhi.
Speaking of science and trains, a famous scientist often used the example of traveling trains to describe a fundamental theory of physics. For today's Science World Quick Quiz, we want to know the name of that scientist. Was it A, Albert Einstein, B, Marie Curie, or C, Stephen Hawking? Do you think you have the right answer? Well, stick around. The correct answer is coming up in just a little bit.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
When well-known actor Michael Douglas recently implied that his throat cancer was caused by the human papillomavirus, or HPV, contracted through oral sex, the news made headlines around the world. As Carol Pearson reports, HPV-caused oral cancer has been on the rise and mostly affects men.
The human papillomavirus, HPV, is actually many different viruses. One particular strain causes oral cancer, and doctors say the number of cases is reaching epidemic levels. Most of the victims are men who live in developed countries. Dr. Mumtaz Khan is a head and neck specialist at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio.
There are almost about 20 million people in the U.S. who have been affected and have this virus. Most of them, however, are not related to that particular HPV-16 virus, which is responsible for oropharyngeal cancer.
Yet Dr. Khan says HPV-16-related cancer is reaching epidemic levels.
The rates of oropharyngeal cancers related to HPV has significantly risen in the last two decades. I can give you an example of several studies quoting the tonsil cancers to be about 28% related to HPV back in the 80s, and now it's up to 68 to 80%.
Right now, there's no way to screen for oral cancer. So Dr. Khan says patients need to monitor themselves regularly.
People should look for anything which is unusual, atypical, something new that is persisting, not going away, like a lump in the neck, a sore in the mouth, difficulty swallowing, change in voice.
Dr. Khan says this type of cancer is very curable, but the infection can be prevented. HPV-16 is one of the viruses targeted by the HPV vaccine. Dr. Khan says as the vaccine becomes more widely used, it's likely there will be fewer cases of this type of oral cancer. In a recent study, however, the number of parents in the U.S. who indicated they would not vaccinate their daughters against HPV increased from 40 to 44%. But the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also recommends that boys be vaccinated against HPV. In one promising study, researchers at the U.S. National Cancer Institute said antibodies against the human papillomavirus may help identify those at risk for HPV-related oral cancer. Although the findings are preliminary, one day, a simple blood test might be able to identify patients at risk. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
China has completed its longest manned space mission yet, marking an important step toward the goal of building its own space station. The return capsule of the Shenzhou 10 spacecraft touched down safely early Wednesday in China's remote Inner Mongolia region. The three astronauts aboard waved and smiled for the cameras after emerging from the capsule. During their 15 days in space, the astronauts successfully docked with and carried out other tests on the Tiangong-1 experimental space module. China views the orbiting lab as a prototype for a permanent space station it hopes to build by 2020. Although it remains behind the U.S. and Russia, China's space program has made major breakthroughs in a relatively short time. In 2003, China sent its first astronaut to space. 5 years later, it completed its first spacewalk. U.S. President Barack Obama, this past Tuesday, laid out his agenda for fighting climate change. As Kent Klein reports from the White House, the president will issue a series of executive orders to address the problem.
Mr. Obama put forth an ambitious, wide-ranging plan aimed at reducing the carbon emissions that are blamed for climate change. and he said the debate over the existence of global warming is obsolete.
The planet is warming, and human activity is contributing to it. The question now is whether we will have the courage to act before it's too late.
At Washington's Georgetown University, the president said one of his main goals is for the government to regulate the amount of heat-trapping carbon dioxide put out by power plants.
But power plants can still dump unlimited amounts of carbon pollution into the air for free. That's not right, it's not safe, and it needs to stop.
Mr. Obama plans to implement his initiatives through executive orders, since Congress has blocked his environmental legislation in the past. The top Senate Republican, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, said Tuesday imposing carbon rules on power plants amounts to an energy tax. McConnell, from the coal-producing state of Kentucky, also blasted Mr. Obama's call to end U.S. support for public financing for new coal-fired plants in other countries.
Declaring a war on coal is tantamount to declaring a war on jobs. It's tantamount to kicking the ladder out from beneath the feet of many Americans struggling in today's economy.
As part of a global effort, Mr. Obama said he would work with China and other major polluters to reduce carbon emissions. He recently reached an agreement with Chinese President Xi Jinping to phase out chlorofluorocarbons, greenhouse gases used in refrigerators and air conditioners.
We compete for business with them, but we also share a planet. And we have to all shoulder the responsibility for keeping the planet habitable, or we're going to suffer the consequences.
The president's initiative would allow more wind and solar energy projects on government land. It would raise government standards for vehicle fuel efficiency, and it would send federal money to local governments to help them deal with the effects of climate change-related weather disasters. Kent Klein, VOA News, the White House.
Okay, let's see if you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz. Today, we wanted to know which famous scientist often used the example of traveling trains to describe a fundamental theory of physics. Was it A, Albert Einstein, B, Marie Curie, or C, Stephen Hawking? Well, the answer is A, Albert Einstein. The famous physicist used the example of one observer traveling on a train and another watching the passing train from an adjoining platform to describe his theory of special relativity. Einstein said, "Whether one is stationary or moving, the observations made from your frame of reference are just as valid as those made by someone else on a different reference frame." Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Scientists using models produced by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, have predicted a very large hypoxic or dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico this summer, possibly the largest ever reported. But, on the other hand, they also forecast a smaller-than-average hypoxic level in the Chesapeake Bay, located along the east coast of the United States. Hypoxic zones are areas where the water contains very low oxygen levels, and anoxic zones are those that have no oxygen at all, both of which means there is insufficient oxygen in those areas to support most marine life in near-bottom waters. Today, Dr. Robert Magnian, the director of NOAA's Center for Sponsored Coastal Ocean Research, joins us in our one-on-one segment to talk about these dire predictions, how scientists were able to make their forecasts, as well as the potential impact these dead zones may have on a body of water such as the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, for the Gulf of Mexico, it looks like this year we're going to have a lot of nutrient pollution coming into the Gulf of Mexico through the Mississippi River, which drains a huge area of the heartland of the United States. And it's these nutrients that are coming into the Gulf that fuel algae blooms. Algae blooms sink to the bottom, and when they decompose, they rob the water of oxygen, hence leading to a hypoxic or dead zone.
You're mentioning hypoxia, and I also understand there's anoxia, and the difference, I guess, is one has some oxygen, some has none.
That's correct. Anoxia is actually the absence of oxygen. Some organisms can survive hypoxia. Almost none, except bacteria, can survive anoxia. And that's more of a problem in the Chesapeake Bay than it is in an area like the Gulf of Mexico.
When we're talking about the Gulf's large area of hypoxia, just how large are we talking about? Can you give us like a reference, an illustration?
Well, this year we're projecting close to a record for the Gulf of Mexico, and that could be upwards of around 8,500 square miles, which is very close to the land area of New Jersey, if that gives anybody a sense of how large this is.
I understand that there are some, at first glance, who might be wondering if 2010's Deepwater Horizon oil spill might be partially responsible for this, is it?
Well, the jury's still out on what all of the effects are from the Deepwater Horizon spill. There doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence so far that it's affecting the hypoxic zone, but that possibility exists, at least to a very small extent.
So we can understand this. These forecasts that have been delivered by these universities are estimates based on models created by your agency. And I understand that an actual survey will take place to take real water measurements to confirm or refute this information. True?
That's true. And in the Chesapeake, they will be conducting routine cruises throughout the summer, and for the Gulf, which is a much larger area, we'll be supporting a cruise in late July and be reporting on that in early August.
Looking back at previous forecasts, previous surveys, how close were the forecasts to the actual findings?
Actually, the forecasts have been very accurate in the past. Where they have not been accurate is when a storm, especially in the Gulf of Mexico, encroaches on the area just before the measurement. And what happens there is that a hurricane or strong storm stirs up the water and reoxygenates it. So we do have a caveat in our press release that indicates if a storm passes just before or during our survey, the forecast may be off somewhat.
I understand that having such a large dead zone is going to have a tremendous impact on people who live and make their living in that area. What areas of impact will these dead zones have?
In the Gulf of Mexico, the area of the dead zone is right over the area that's typically some of the best habitat for shrimp. So when the dead zone forms in the summer, the shrimp are pushed off to the side. They can move out of the way. And that's one of the big impacts we see. And we're also finding from our research that fish can be affected, maybe in not so obvious ways, but in reproduction, the loss of reproduction, and those kinds of things. So we're still working on understanding all of the impacts of these hypoxic zones.
I understand that another forecast from the University of Maryland, despite the bad news coming from the Gulf, that it is providing some encouraging news about the Chesapeake.
Yes, that's correct. The Chesapeake forecast is actually for a less than average sized dead zone, and that's partially due to river flows that are below the normal, unlike the Gulf this year. And it also seems that the nutrient pollution control measures that have been implemented in the watershed of the Chesapeake are starting to show some benefits. That is, we're getting less nutrient pollution flowing into the Chesapeake.
If these forecasts are indeed proven true, how long would those regions in the Gulf of Mexico be dead? And can they come back? And if so, what would need to happen?
Well, the hypoxic zone in the Gulf forms every summer, and then it dissipates in the fall and winter. So it is a seasonal phenomena, and the organisms are primarily affected at that time of year. But fortunately, with the current human activities in the watershed and the pollution flowing downstream, that zone forms every single year and impacts the organisms every year during the summer.
That was Dr. Robert Magnian, director of NOAA's Center for Sponsored Coastal Ocean Research, located in Silver Spring, Maryland. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.